The Arizona Daily Star for Thursday, December 18th. Mark DeGroft with you. From Washington, Trump says he is ordering a blockade of all sanctioned oil tankers into Venezuela, ramping up pressure on the country's authoritarian leader, Nicolas Maduro, in a move that seemed designed to put a tighter chokehold on the South American country's economy. Trump's escalation comes after the United States forces last week seized an oil tanker off Venezuela's coast, an unusual move that followed a buildup of military forces in the region. In a post on social media on Tuesday night announcing the blockade, Trump alleged Venezuela was using oil to fund drug trafficking and other crimes and vowed to continue the military buildup until the country gave the U.S. oil, land, and assets, though it was not clear why he felt the U.S. had a claim. Venezuela is completely surrounded by the largest armada ever assembled in the history of South America, Trump said in a post on his social media platform. It will only get bigger, and the shock to them will be like nothing they've ever seen before, until such a time as they return to the United States of America all of the oil, land, and other assets that they previously stole from us. Pentagon officials referred all questions about the post to the White House. Venezuela's government released a statement Tuesday accusing Trump of violating international law of free trade and the principle of free navigation with a reckless and grave threat against the South American country. On his social media, he assumes Venezuela oil, land, and mineral wealth are his property, the statement said of Trump's post. Consequently, he demands that Venezuela immediately hand over all of its riches. The President of the United States intends to impose, in an utterly irrational manner, a proposed naval blockade on Venezuela with the aim of stealing the wealth that belongs to our nation. Maduro's government, according to the statement, plans to denounce the situation before the United Nations. The U.S. buildup has been accompanied by a series of military strikes on boats in international waters in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific. The campaign, which has drawn bipartisan scrutiny among U.S. lawmakers, has killed at least 95 people in 25 known strikes on its vessels. Trump has for weeks said that the U.S. will move its campaign beyond water and start strikes on land. The Trump administration has defended the strikes as a success, saying they have prevented drugs from reaching American shores and pushed back on concerns that they are stretching the bounds of lawful warfare. The Trump administration has said the campaign is about stopping drugs headed into the United States, but Trump's chief of staff, Susie Wiles, appeared to confirm in a Vanity Fair interview published on Tuesday that the campaign is sort of a push to oust Maduro. Wiles said Trump wants to keep on blowing boats up until Maduro cries uncle. Tuesday night's announcement seemed to have a similar aim. Venezuela, which has the world's largest proven oil reserves and produces about 1 million barrels of oil a day, has long relied on oil revenue as a lifeblood of its economy. And since the Trump administration began imposing oil sanctions on Venezuela in 2017, Maduro's government has relied on a shadowy fleet of unflagged tankers to smuggle crude into global supply chains. The state-mandated middle housing law that makes building duplexes, townhomes, and other more affordable housing on existing lots easier will be implemented across Tucson, rather than confined to a smaller portion of the city. In a 6-1 vote, the council said the middle housing change will encompass the city's whole 243-square-mile area, excluding areas such as the city of South Tucson, Davis-Monthan, and county-owned property, as well as rural residential areas. Councilmember Miranda Schubert made the motion to implement the citywide option. Folks don't like change, but we need to do things differently because we are facing unprecedented times, she said. What we do have is a precedent for middle housing. There's a lot of different kinds of people in Tucson, and we just don't have a lot of different kinds of housing for them, everyone from college students to working professionals, she said. Councilwoman Selena Baraja said she wants to see residents stay and grow in Tucson or return to the city as she did, and middle housing is a step closer to achieve that. There's been some talk about unintended consequences, and to me this is an argument against a more incremental approach, because inaction also leads to unintended consequences, and our housing emergency is real. It's here, it's right now, and without bold action it's not going away, Baraha said. Middle housing is one of the many tools we must pass. We won't solve everything, but we need multiple strategies in order to effectively address our emergency and meet our long-term housing needs. The new state law requires cities with a population of at least 75,000 people to more easily allow for the development of duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes, and townhomes on all lots zoned for single-family use within 1 mile of their central business district. The state law goes into effect on January 1st. City staff had recommended that the middle housing area be closer to Tucson's central business district boundaries, roughly Prince Road on the north, Silver Lake Road on the south, Country Club on the east, and Silver Bell Road on the west. A third option was even smaller. Dahl, ahead of the vote for citywide implementation, made a substitute motion to have the city council weigh a fourth proposal. He had asked staff for the smallest possible area, which encompassed the city's business improvement district, plus 1 mile, but it failed by a 3-4 vote, with Mayor Regina Romero and council members Lane Santa Cruz, Schubert, and Barajas voting against it. Dahl said he wouldn't support a citywide option or the staff-recommended option as a precaution for unintended consequences. If 60% of everybody who responded, most of the Planning Commission, if one or two people are opposing it because something horrible will happen in some neighborhood, I would like to know that before we do it citywide, simply because the state legislature won't let us take it back, Dahl said. I like middle housing. I've lived in middle housing. I would like to support it statewide, but I'm irritated as heck that this is being forced on us by the state legislature, Dahl said. People who are not involved in zoning, who don't oversee departments that do permitting, that aren't responding and moving in into building things, that just ideologically prefer that we deal with the housing issue through a more permitting stuff rather than doing the real things, like funding public housing and giving us the tools, like rent stabilization. The new state law does not allow cities to mandate affordable housing, but city officials have said research shows increasing housing stock positively impacts affordability. Among the requirements of the new state law, cities are prohibited from restricting, that is, middle housing to less than 2 stories, setting permitting rules that are more restrictive than for single-family homes, requiring owner occupancy of any structure on the lot, setting parking requirements. Newer home subdivisions with established homeowner associations within any middle housing boundaries, the city says, are exempt from the new state law. In Phoenix, city leaders voted to allow up to 4 dwelling units per single-family lot within 1 mile of the downtown boundary, and to require at least 20% of all new subdivisions of 10 continuous acres or more comply with the regulations. Flagstaff, like Tucson, adopted middle housing citywide. White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles offered an unusually candid look inside of Trump's administration in a series of interviews published on Tuesday by Vanity Fair magazine, delivering details and reservations that presidential aides usually save for their memoirs. From criticizing Attorney General Pam Bondi as having whiffed on the General Epstein case to say that no rational person could believe Elon Musk did a good job dismantling the United States Agency for International Development, Wiles revealed her own thoughts about her boss and the work of his aggressive administration. The assessments are even more notable because Wiles, before now, has maintained a low profile. She dismissed Vanity Fair's work as a hit piece, and a number of cabinet officials and other aides rushed to her defense. But Wiles notably has not denied any of those details or quotes. And here are some takeaways from Wiles' interview. Wiles defends Trump and compares him to an alcoholic. Wiles described Trump as an intense figure who thinks in broad strokes yet is often unconcerned about process and policy details. She assessed Trump as having an alcoholic's personality, even though the president doesn't drink. But the personality trait is something she recognizes from her father, the famous sports broadcaster Pat Summerall. High-functioning alcoholics, or alcoholics in general, their personalities are exaggerated when they drink, and so I'm a little bit of an expert in big personalities, she said. Said Wiles, I'm not an enabler. I try to be thoughtful about what I engage in. I guess time will tell whether it's been effective. Trump's revenge crusade too long. Wiles affirmed Trump's ruthlessness and determination to achieve retribution against those he considers his political enemies, especially those who prosecuted him. We have a loose agreement that the score setting will end before the first 90 days are over, Wiles said early in Trump's second administration, telling Vanity Fair she did try to tamp down Trump's penchant for retribution. But in August of 2025, she shifted. I don't think he's on a retribution tour, she said, arguing Trump has a different principle. I don't want what happened to me to happen to somebody else. Still, she said, there may be an element of that from time to time, and Trump will go for it when there's an opportunity. Who would blame him? She asked rhetorically. Not me. Asked about the prosecution of New York Attorney General Letitia James for mortgage fraud, Wiles allowed, well, that might be the one retribution. In some of her most eye-popping commentary, Wiles said that Attorney General Pam Bondi whiffed on handling the Jeffrey Epstein sex trafficking case, particularly trying to manage public expectations by suggesting the Justice Department had a client list waiting to be disclosed only for the administration to later say that it doesn't exist. The president was wrong about that. She also said that Trump pushed false narratives that former President Bill Clinton frequented Epstein's infamous island. There's no evidence those visits happened, according to Wiles, and there are no damning findings concerning Clinton at all. Wiles often sits to the side in the Oval Office, out of camera view, but she's paying attention. Vice President J.D. Vance has been a conspiracy theorist for decades, she said, and his MAGA conversion, he once compared Trump to Adolf Hitler, was sort of political. Elon Musk overstepped on his Department of Government efficiency efforts, she said. She called him a complete solo actor, an odd duck, and an avowed ketamine user. Musk has acknowledged using the dissociative anesthetic. She recalled having to explain to him that you can't just lock people out of their offices, and said his gutting of USAID left her initially aghast, because I think anybody that pays attention to government and has ever paid attention to USAID believed, as I did, they do some very good work, she said, adding that no rational person could think that the USAID process was a good one, nobody. She calls Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Quirky Bobby, and White House Budget Chief Russell Voigt a right-wing absolute zealot. But in praising Kennedy, Wiles explained her embrace of the administration's hardliners, he pushes the envelope. Some would say too far, but I say in order to get back to the middle, you have to push it too far. Few events undermine Trump's standing quite like his April 2nd announcement of Liberation Day tariffs, in which he announced import taxes ranging from 10 to 99% on most of the world. Trump's move sparked recession fears and a delay in imposing his wider tariff strategy, leading to a roller coaster of negotiations and new tariff threats. Wiles called the April rollout so much thinking out loud and said there were internal disputes about it among Trump's aides. She told the aides to work into what she's already thinking and asked Vance to tell Trump not to talk about tariffs today until his term was in complete unity. His team, that is, was in complete unity. But Trump proceeded on his own. Wiles said that she believed a middle ground on tariffs would be successful, but she concluded it's been more painful than I expected. when a federal judge chided the administration for deporting Maryland resident Kilmar Abrego Garcia, Trump publicly defended the approach, despite the administration telling the court that it was a mistake. Wiles did not mince words, telling Vanity Fair at the time, "We've got to look harder at our process for deportation." When the administration deported two mothers and their U.S. citizen children, including one who was a cancer patient, Wiles was even more plain-spoken. "It could be an overzealous Border Patrol agent, I don't know. I can't understand how you could make that mistake, but somebody did." After nearly 4 years of fighting, Trump has made the case that Russian President Vladimir Putin can be persuaded in the war in Ukraine if Kyiv agrees to cede Ukrainian land in the eastern Donbas region, and if Western powers offer economic incentives that would bring Russia back to the economic world order. "I actually think that President Putin wants to see it end," Trump told reporters on Monday. But Wiles offered a deep skepticism to Vanity Fair about Putin. "The experts think that it would get the rest of Donetsk, then he would be happy," Wiley said in August, referring to the oblast that is a key part of Donbas. "Trump thinks he wants the whole country," Wiles told her interviewer. She said in November that Trump wants to keep on blowing boats up until Maduro cries uncle. Trump has repeatedly said Maduro's days are numbered as the U.S. intensifies deadly attacks on vessels in the Caribbean Sea and the Eastern Pacific. The administration alleges the targets are drug smuggling cartels. Still, Trump and administration officials have stopped short of saying they want people to topple the Maduro regime. They insist the strikes, which have killed at least 95 people in 25 known incidents since September, are a strategy to stem the flow of fentanyl and other illegal drugs into the United States. Tucson and regional news at quarter after the hour. A popular burger chain is set to open a third location in Casas Adobes Plaza. A location for the New York-based Shake Shack is currently under construction at 3105 North Campbell Avenue. Another location is at 5545 East Broadway near Williams Center, and it is scheduled to open in 2026. The Northwest Side location will be located at 633 West Ina Road. The casual eatery features hamburgers, sandwiches, and a variety of milkshakes and drinks. Shake Shack is currently hiring for three locations. Visit careers, shakeshack.com, and click on Tucson for details on open positions. From Phoenix, more than a dozen years ago, Senator John Kavanaugh voted along every Republican in the Arizona legislature to require any firearm used in a crime to be sold off to raise money for local governments. Now the Fountain Hills Republican is having second thoughts. The reason? A weapon that could now be sold and put back into public circulation was used to kill a Phoenix police officer. Kavanaugh says what changed his mind was Julie Early filing a lawsuit in October to prevent the city of Phoenix from selling off a gun that was used in 2007 to kill her husband, Nick, during an attempted arrest. The gunman fled the scene but was later killed by the police. Erfel said that she believed that the weapon had since been destroyed. It was only after she inquired earlier this year whether police had ever done a trace on the weapon to find out who supplied the gun, but they had not, that she learned it was still being held as evidence, even though there was no active case for which it was needed. And that, she said in her lawsuit, leads to her belief that the gun will be sold, allowing the city of Phoenix to profit from the sale of a weapon used to murder her husband. Early contends that, at the very least, the city should be required to consult with her under the Victim's Bill of Rights before taking any further action about the gun. That 1990 voter-approved measure required police and prosecutors to keep victims and their families informed of every development in a case, including consultation in some cases. In this case, Erfel said, the city broke the law by not keeping her informed of the fact that the gun was not destroyed and could now be sold. But she says she also wants Maricopa County Superior Court Judge Scott Blaney to issue an injunction preventing the gun's destruction while her lawsuit is pending. And ultimately, Erfel wants the judge to direct the city to destroy it. The original requirement to sell off seized weapons was approved in 2013. The idea was that there was no reason to destroy a perfectly good gun just because it was used in a crime or turned in by an owner. A lobbyist for the Arizona State Rifle and Pistol Association, the local chapter of the National Rifle Association, said government resources were being wasted by collecting and destroying weapons. The Pentagon is opening a fact-finding investigation of Senator Mark Kelly over his role in a controversial video, a step the agency characterized as escalating the matter with the former Navy combat pilot. The move comes as Kelly, a Democrat from Arizona, seemed to outline his legal defense in a December 15th letter to the Navy that promised to fight what they called unprecedented and dangerous overreach. Together, the actions suggest no near-term end of the fallout from the November 18th video that Kelly made with five other Democrats, telling the members of the military they must refuse illegal orders. In a statement, the War Department said it is escalating the preliminary review of Kelly to an official command investigation, according to Punchbowl News. That's a process that's intended to gather facts and can lead to outcomes ranging from a reprimand to a court-martial. Kelly's letter echoed the defiant tone that he has struck in the weeks since Trump and War Secretary Hegseth deemed it seditious, though it essentially repeats military law that even Hegseth cited years earlier. There's no legitimate basis for any type of proceeding against Senator Kelly, and any such effort would be unconstitutional and an extraordinary abuse of power, the letter said. If the executive branch were to move forward in any forum, criminal, disciplinary, or administrative, we will take all appropriate legal action on Senator Kelly's behalf to halt the administration's unprecedented and dangerous overreach. In a written statement, Kelly said the continuation of the matter could have a chilling effect on others. It should send a shiver down the spine of every patriotic American that the President and Secretary of Defense would abuse their power to come after me or anybody in this way. It wasn't enough for Trump to say I should be hanged. It wasn't enough for Hegseth to threaten me with a court-martial. Now they're threatening everything I fought and served for across 25 years in the United States Navy, all because I repeated something every service member is taught. Kelly faces possible discipline from the Pentagon over his participation in the video, while he and the other five Democrats in the video also face FBI review as well. Kelly has consistently cast the Pentagon and Justice Department actions as an effort to intimidate him that he said will not work. The Pima County Board of Supervisors approved a binding agreement between the county and Beale Infrastructure, the developers of the Project Blue Data Centers complex, on several community benefit investments that the company commits to. County supervisors passed the agreement by a 3-2 vote, with supervisors Andres Cano and Jen Allen voting no. Members of labor unions spoke to the board during the Tuesday meeting's call to the audience portion to support the agreement and the data center project at large, while other members of the public, including some of the No Desert Data Center Coalition, spoke out in opposition. The agreement negotiated between county administration and Beale outlines $15 million in community investments, along with the developer's pledge to match 100% of the data center's energy use with renewable energy under terms of the developer committed to in early November, County Administrator Jan Lesher said in a memo to the board last week. Key aspects of the agreement are that the data centers will be air-cooled instead of water-cooled, that water for domestic applications like kitchens, bathrooms, and fire suppression systems will be obtained from a source approved by the Arizona Department of Water Resources, and that Beale Infrastructure will use commercially available means to match its energy consumption with renewable energy, but details in the proposed agreement on how Beale will do so are pretty sparse. Cano said the county needs more good-paying jobs in the region, but he doesn't believe Project Blue is the way to get them. Throughout the United States, Communities are warning us when the government approved massive data center deals without enforceable guardrails. Harm to public health, strain on water and energy, and residents losing their right to say yes or no. We cannot rush deals like this for short-term gains, because the costs do not stay short-term. They linger in our bodies, in our neighborhoods, and in our public trust, Cano said. Our community has lived the price of trust us. While we have lived the consequences of secrecy, we have lived the damage done when public health is treated as an afterthought, when residents are asked to carry the risk while someone else collects the reward, he continued. That is why I cannot support Project Blue in its original or current form. Allen, the other no vote, said the economic benefits touted by supporters of the data center project do not outweigh short and long-term costs. Our vote in June opened up the floodgates, and now we're all going to have to deal with the consequences. The floodgates of not just what's happening on the 290 acres of county-owned land, but looking at what's happening in Marana, what could be happening in Suarita, and what could be happening on Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, she said. Data centers now saw an opening, and they've jumped in and are wedging that opening into something larger, and we are still not prepared for the impacts and the consequences of that. The University of Arizona President Suresh Garamala has a new chief of staff for the second time in a little less than a year. Francisco Garcia, who held the position since early January, is leaving. Rachel Reinhardt, U of A's former associate vice president for research communications, started in the $275,000 a year role on December 15th. She will provide strategic counsel to Garamella and oversee key institutional priorities and operations, Garamella said in a notice to campus. She will coordinate the work of senior university administrators, contribute to the decision-making process, supervise critical issues and relationships, and ensure the overall effective functioning of the president's office, he said. Rachel brings more than two decades of senior leadership in complex research and academic organizations, with a career dedicated to defining priorities, strengthening alignment, and helping institutions move forward with confidence and purpose, he wrote. Reinhardt, who holds a Bachelor of Arts in French and International Studies from Yale, has been at the U of A since 2023 in different positions, including Associate Vice President for Communications for Health Sciences. Garamella's note wished Garcia well, saying he's returning to work in public health and medicine. A U of A spokesperson declined to comment on why Garcia left within a year. He was the university's first chief of staff to the president, a role created this year that combined two former administrators' roles. Garamella wrote that Garcia forged important relationships for him and the president's office, coordinated the interactions with the Arizona Board of Regents, and worked tirelessly to promote our accomplishments, uplift our students, faculty, and staff, and bring realignment and focus to our work. Looking at business at 28 past the hour, Roomba maker iRobot filed for bankruptcy and will go private after being acquired by its Chinese supplier, Piscio Robotics. Founded 35 years ago, the Massachusetts company pioneered the development of home vacuum robots and grew to become one of the most recognizable American consumer brands. Over the years, it lost ground to Chinese competitors with less expensive products. This year, the company was clobbered by Trump's tariffs. At its peak during the pandemic, a robot was valued at $3 billion. The bankruptcy filing, which happened on Sunday, had raised fear among Roomba users who were worried about bricking, which is when a device stops working or is rendered useless due to lack of software updates. iRobot has tried assuaging the fears, saying that it will continue operations with no anticipated disruption to its application functionality, consumer programs, or product support. The majority of iRobot products sold in the United States are manufactured in Vietnam, which was hit with a 46% tariff, eroding profits and competitiveness of the company. The tariffs increase iRobot's cost by $23 million in 2025, according to its court filings. In 2024, iRobot's revenue stood at $681 million, about 24% lower than the previous year. The company owned hundreds of millions in debt and long-term loans, and once the court-supervised transaction is complete, iRobot will become a private company owned by contract manufacturer Piesse Robotics. Today, nearly 70% of the global smart vacuum robot market is dominated by the Chinese brands, according to IDC, with Roborock and Ecovacs leading the charge. The sale of a famous household brand to Chinese competitor has prompted complaints from Silicon Valley entrepreneurs and politicians, citing the case as a failure of antitrust policy. Amazon originally planned to acquire iRobot for $1.4 billion, but in early 2024 it terminated the merger after scrutiny from European regulators, supported by then Federal Trade Commission Chair Lina Khan. iRobot never recovered from that. The central concern for the merger was that Amazon could unduly favor iRobot products in its marketplace, according to Joseph Coniglio, who's the director of antitrust and innovation at the think tank Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. Buying iRobot could have expanded Amazon's portfolio of home devices, including Ring and Alexa, he said, bolstering American competition in the robot vacuum market. Blocking the deal was a strategic error, said Dick Auer, director of competition policy at the International Center for Law and Economics. The consequence is that we're handed an easy win to Chinese rivals. iRobot was the only significant Western player left in this space. By denying them the resources needed to compete, regulators have left American consumers with fewer alternatives to Chinese dominance. California led a coalition of 16 states on Tuesday to sue the Trump administration in an effort to free up billions of dollars in federal funds that are intended to build and repair electric vehicle charging stations that it argues the White House is illegally blocked. Attorney General Bob Bonta said the U.S. Department of Transportation did not have the authority to suspend $180 million to fund EV charging programs in California, which Congress and former President Biden had already approved in 2021 as part of the landmark Bipartisan Infrastructure Act. This is funding that was lawfully directed to states and local communities by Congress, Bonta said in a news conference. Trump is putting the brakes on projects that would reduce planet warming pollution and smog, expand access to clean vehicles, and create thousands of green jobs, he added. The 2022 law provided $63 million to Caltrans to repair broken EV chargers around the state, $55.9 million for zero-emission projects at major ports like Oakland and Los Angeles, and $59.3 million to Caltrans to build chargers for electric trucks, delivery vehicles, and buses. California has more electric vehicles than any other state. Last year in California, 25.3% of the new vehicles sold were electric, according to the California Energy Commission. In some counties, the number is even higher. In Santa Clara County, 43.8% of the new passenger vehicles purchased last year were zero emission, basically electric or plug-in hybrid. In Marin County, it was 40.1%, Alameda County, 37.7%, Contra Costa County, 32.7%, San Mateo County, 25.3%, and San Francisco, 35.6%. It was 31% in Orange County and 26.5% in Los Angeles County. The top-selling car in California for the past 3 years has been the Tesla Model Y, according to data from the California New Car Dealers Association, surpassing Honda Civic, Toyota Corolla, and other traditional gasoline-powered vehicles that once led sales. To the opinion page, letters to the editor, Robert Cafes from Midtown writes, Our president is abominable in more ways than I can count. The latest abomination is his shameful response, if only he felt shame, to the Reiner family tragedy. Daily, he repeated, brings dishonor to this country. If anybody is deranged, it is the man himself. There is no bottom to DJT's destructive, disgraceful, and delusional statements and behavior. And it's beyond terrifying that he has in his hands the nuclear codes. It would be wise for the American media not to continue to turn a blind eye to the extreme danger this seriously mentally ill man poses to the world. And Kenneth Haber from the Northwest Side, it's hard to believe it took until now for the hater-in-chief and the bigot-in-chief, HICBIC, to show his true colors. Tragically, it took the Reiner's deaths for him to come out. We knew about Somalis and Afghanis and blacks and Democrats and most others not born in South Africa or in Scandinavia, but the scurrilous rant is beyond. Apparently, only an Orban, Kirk, or Putin is acceptable. Reassessment and reconsideration by his loyalists is long overdue. David Reynolds from the East Side, yet another Central Arizona Republican, is pushing to have repackaged theology taught in science classrooms again. And we wonder why American students are falling behind in things like science and math. Barbara Benjamin from the Foothills, the adage says that a small child shall lead us, supposing the adage is incorrect and a grown man who shall lead us. Thanks to Ahmed Al-Ahmed, the Australian gunmen were taken down. Al-Ahmed used his humanity to take down the gunmen, killing Jews celebrating Hanukkah. Perhaps it is a small sign that Jews and Muslims can come together in decency and humanity and recognize that they are not the enemy. Their mutual enemy are those who manipulate their anger and cause their mutual deaths. One can only hope that one day. And Diane Daniels from the Northeast Side, I love Winter Haven. It's a beloved Tucson tradition. How is it that the Arizona Daily Star does not know this? Somehow, our beloved local tradition had been sidelined or QR'd in favor of gunmen at Brown University and gun laws in Australia, etc., etc. So instead of being able to read a story about our beloved tradition, we're invited to a QR code and read it on our phones. Not acceptable for lots of reasons, including I don't know how to QR things. I suggest the Star relegate guns to the QR world and let me read an article in print about my beloved Winter Haven. And Jeffrey McConnell from the West Side writes, reports of raids on Tucson's Taco Hero restaurants got me thinking about wearing masks in post-COVID America. In my visits to Japan beginning decades ago, I was surprised to see citizens walking the streets wearing face covers and informed that they were masked to protect others from their cold or flu, and quite surprised by this level of civility. Fly east across the Pacific Ocean and landing in 2025 America, we'd find all acronyms of policing forces hiding their faces. There should have no flu, but doxing, meaning that facial exposure can be traced to their families, and their social vulnerable children will receive text messages saying that their parents are Nazis. No prom dates. College students show up to protest with faces hidden by Palestinian keffiyehs and then return to their dorm rooms to protect themselves from any response to their free speech. And they get dates. It's time to start learning Japanese. National World News at 20 till. From Washington, four centrist Republicans broke with Speaker Mike Johnson on Wednesday and joined a Democratic-led petition that will force a House vote on extending for 3 years an enhanced pandemic-era subsidy that lowers health insurance costs for millions of Americans. The move comes after House Republican leaders pushed ahead with a health care bill that does not address the soaring monthly premiums that millions of people will soon endure when the tax credits for those who buy insurance through the Affordable Care Act expire at this year's end. The action sets the stage for a renewed inter-party clash after over health care in January, something Republican leaders tried to avoid just weeks before another government funding deadline at the end of that month. The moderate Republicans were able to force the issues by signing a petition led by Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York to vote on a bill that would extend the subsidies for 3 years. Republican Representatives Brian Fitzpatrick, Robert Breschinen, and Ryan McKenzie, all from Pennsylvania, and Mike Lawler of New York, signed on Wednesday morning, pushing it to 218. A vote on the subsidy bill could come as soon as January under the House rules. Unfortunately, it is House leadership themselves that have forced this outcome, Fitzpatrick said in a statement. Johnson told reporters on Wednesday that, "I have not lost control of the House," and he noted that Republicans have a razor-thin majority that allows a small number of members to employ procedures that would not usually be successful in getting around the leadership. The revolt against GOP leadership came after days of talks that were centered on health care subsidies. Johnson discussed allowing more politically vulnerable GOP lawmakers a chance to vote on bills that would temporarily extend the subsidies while also adding changes such as income caps for beneficiaries. After days of discussions, the leadership sided with the more conservative wing of the party's conference, which assailed the subsidies as propping up a failed ACA program, which is widely known as Obamacare. The GOP holds a 220 to 213 majority in the House, which means deflections from just a sliver of the conference can upend leadership's plans. The defectors largely represent districts that Democrats targeted in their bid to take the majority, with Democrats promising to make health insurance costs a central issue in next year's midterm elections. From the Digest, Washington, FBI Director, Deputy Director Dan Bognino said on Wednesday that he would resign from the Bureau next month, ending a brief and tumultuous tenure in which he clashed with the Justice Department over the handling of the Jeffrey Epstein files and was forced to reconcile the realities of his law enforcement job with provocative claims he made in his prior role as a popular podcast host. The departure would be among the highest-profile resignations of the Trump administration, coming as the firing of career agents has contributed to upheaval at the FBI, and as Director Prakash Patel faces continued criticism over his use of a government plane for personal purposes and social media posts about active investigations. Bognino announced his departure, which was expected, in a post on X, in which he said he was grateful for the opportunity to serve with purpose. He didn't say precisely when in January that he would leave or reveal his plans. Again from Washington, Democratic senators on Wednesday hammered the Federal Communications Commission's leader for pressuring broadcasters to take ABC late night host Jimmy Kimmel off the air, suggesting that Brendan Carr was politicizing an independent agency and trampling the First Amendment. The FCC chairman refused to disown his comments about Kimmel, and when questioned by Democrats about an agency long considered autonomous, suggested it was not insulated from Trump's pressure. The FCC is not an independent agency, Carr said. Briefly, Jeffrey Epstein's former girlfriend and longtime associate Ghislaine Maxwell asked a federal judge on Wednesday to set aside her sex trafficking conviction and free her from a 20-year prison sentence, saying substantial new evidence has emerged. A federal judge in Washington, D.C., temporarily blocked the Trump administration from enforcing policies that would limit Congress members' access to immigration detention facilities. The judge ruled on Wednesday that it is likely illegal for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement to demand a week's notice from members of Congress seeking to visit ICE facilities. From Massachusetts, police intensified their search on Wednesday for a suspect in the killing of Professor Nuno F. G. Loureiro, 47 years old, at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, 2 days after he was shot at his home outside of Boston. From Australia, Naveed Akram, the accused gunman in Sydney's Bondi Beach massacre on Sunday, was charged on Wednesday with 59 offenses, including 15 charges of murder, as hundreds of mourners gathered in Sydney to begin funerals for the victims. From the Ukraine, speaking at an annual meeting with top military officers, Russian President Vladimir Putin warned Wednesday that Moscow will seek it to extend its gain in the Ukraine if Kyiv and its Western allies reject the Kremlin's demands in peace talks. And high winds toppled trees and power lines Wednesday across parts of Washington State and Idaho, killing and compounding the damage wrought by more than a week of heavy rains. From Washington, former Justice Department Special Counsel Jack Smith told lawmakers in a closed-door interview on Wednesday that his team of investigators developed proof beyond a reasonable doubt that Trump criminally conspired to overturn the results of the 2020 election, according to portions of his opening statement that have been obtained by the Associated Press. Smith said that investigators had accrued powerful evidence that Trump broke the law by hoarding classified documents from his first term as president at his Mar-a-Lago estate in Palm Beach, Florida, and by obstructing government efforts to recover those records. "I made my decisions in the investigation without regard to Trump's political association, his activities, beliefs, or candidacy in the 2024 election," Smith said. He said that if asked whether he would prosecute a former president based on the same facts today, he said, "I would do so regardless of whether the president was a Republican or a Democrat." The Republican-led committee subpoenaed Smith this month to provide testimony and documents as part of a GOP investigation into the Trump inquiries during President Joe Biden's administration. The former special counsel cooperated with the congressional demand, though his lawyers noted that he volunteered more than a month before the subpoena to answer questions publicly before the committee, an overture, they said, was rebuffed by Republicans. Trump told reporters that he had supported the idea of one hearing. Smith was appointed in 2022 to oversee the Justice Department investigations into Trump's efforts to overturn his 2020 loss to Biden and Trump's hoarding of classified documents at Mar-a-Lago. Smith's team filed charges in both investigations, but abandoned the cases after Trump was elected to the White House again last year, citing Justice Department legal options that say a sitting president cannot be indicted. Multiple prior Justice Department special counsels, including Robert Mueller, have testified publicly, but Smith was summoned for just a private interview. Several Democrats who emerged from Smith's interview said they could understand why Republicans did not want an open hearing based on the damaging testimony about Trump they said that Smith offered. From Jerusalem, Israeli troops fired a mortar shell over the ceasefire line into a Palestinian residential area in the Gaza Strip in the latest incident to rock the tenuous ceasefire with Hamas. Health officials said that at least 10 people were wounded, and the army said that it was investigating. The military said the mortar was fired during an operation in the area of the Yellow Line, which was drawn in the ceasefire agreement and divides the Israeli-held majority of Gaza from the rest of the territory. The military did not say what troops were doing or whether they crossed the line. It claimed the mortar veered from its intended target, which it did not specify. Fadel Naim, director of Al-Hali Hospital, said the hospital received 10 people wounded in the strike on central Gaza City, some critically. It was not the first time since the ceasefire took effect on October 10th that Israeli fire has caused Palestinian casualties outside of the Yellow Line. Health officials reported more than 370 deaths from Israeli fire since the truce. Israel has said it opened fire in response to Hamas violations and claims most of those killed were Hamas militants. From Washington, a federal appeals court ruled on Wednesday that the National Guard deployment in the nation's capital can continue for now, staying a lower court ruling that ordered an end to the troops' presence. The three-panel judge for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit ruled that Trump might prevail in his argument that the presidents possess a unique power to mobilize the Guard in Washington, which is a federal district. The ruling stops the implementation of U.S. District Court Judge Gia Cobb's November 20th opinion and order, and reaffirms that residents and visitors to Washington will routinely see Guard members well into the year 2026. Cobb ruled that the deployment illegally intrudes on local officials' authority to direct law enforcement. Wednesday's unanimous 32-page ruling went on to say that other factors also favored the Republican administration, including the disruption to the lives of thousands of service members, as well as what it says was the president's interest in the protection of the federal government functions and property within the nation's capital. On a lighter note, the December winter solstice is this coming Sunday, December 21st, at 8:02 in the morning, Tucson time, when the sun reaches its southernmost position in the sky of 23.44 degrees south latitude. It will be directly over the Tropic of Capricorn. This is the first day of winter for us in the northern hemisphere, and the first day of summer in the southern hemisphere. The Tropic of Cancer at 23.44 degrees north latitude is the northern equivalent of the Tropic of Capricorn. The region between these two lines is called the Tropics. The term tropic is derived from a Greek word meaning turn, change of direction, or change of circumstance, because the sun appears to turn back at the solstices and reverses direction in the sky. The tropic names come to us from the last centuries B.C., when the sun was in the constellation Cancer the Crab at the summer solstice and in Capricornius the Sea Goat at the winter solstice. At 7:30 p.m., Cetus the Sea Monster is directly south and about halfway up from the southern horizon. Andromeda, the princess, was rescued from Cetus by Perseus, the hero. Cetus is a large constellation, but it lacks the brightness and grandeur of Andromeda and Perseus. At its western end is Deneb Ketos, a bright star visible even in the light-polluted skies. Deneb Ketos is 96 light-years away and has a mass three times that of the sun, with a luminosity 145 times that of the sun. And taking a look at sports, what's happening? Coming up, number one Arizona, undefeated at 10-0, versus San Diego State, they're 5-3. It's at 8:30 p.m. Saturday evening from the Mortgage Matchup Center in Phoenix, and it's available to watch on ESPN2, and you can listen to it on 1290 AM. All the ingredients were lined up to give Braden Burries, Jaden Bradley, and their Arizona Wildcats teammates a pretty nasty hangover earlier this week, or at least enough to feel human nature tugging at them, before they rolled over Abilene Christian 96-62 on Tuesday. The Cats enjoyed a big weekend in Alabama. They beat the Crimson Tide 96-75 in Birmingham late on Saturday night, complete with a 28-point breakout performance from Burries before an ESPN audience and an increasingly quiet pro-Alabama crowd at the Legacy Arena. And by Monday morning, the game helped the Wildcats increase their grip on the number one ranking in the Associated Press Top 25 poll, in which they gained 9 more first-place votes. And if all that didn't threaten complacency with mid-major Abilene Christian coming to town on Tuesday, fatigue could have. The Wildcats' charter flight from Birmingham to Tucson took over 3 hours and didn't land until 2:57 on Sunday morning. That meant the Cats could only try to sleep in later on Sunday morning, attempt to refocus during a Sunday afternoon practice, and then go through a full day of prep before a game on Tuesday that was sandwiched between Alabama and San Diego State, their opponent on Saturday in Phoenix. But that was enough, for this team at least, a team ranked number one and full of NBA prospects who know what life might be like ahead. Patrick Mahomes from the Chiefs has begun rehab following surgery to repair 2 torn ligaments in his left knee, and the team is optimistic that the 2-time MVP could be back early next season, perhaps even by press time, Kansas City plays week one. Rick Burkholder, the vice president of sports medicine and performance, said Wednesday that the procedure performed in Dallas by Dr. Dan Cooper on Monday night went very well. The operation happened about 24 hours after Mahomes tore his ACL and LCL in a loss to the Chargers. The recovery time for such an injury is about 9 months, though it could vary by several months depending on various factors. Next season, it's expected to kick off on September 10th in 2026, and the Chiefs could play their first game just a few days later. The loss to the Chargers eliminated the Chiefs from postseason contention, ending that streak at a decade. They'd also won the past 9 AFC West titles, reached the previous 7 conference championship games, and played in the last 3 Super Bowls. Now backup Gardner Minshew will quarterback them through the final 3 games beginning Sunday at Tallahassee. And the Chiefs could be missing several big names beyond their star quarterback. And from Miami Gardens, the Dolphins quarterback Tua Tagovailoa was unsure what his future with the team would look like following Wednesday's benching for rookie Quinn Ewers. For now, the former first-round draft pick said he will contribute in whatever way he can despite his disappointment with how his season has gone. The decision came after Tagovailoa struggled in a loss to the Steelers, which eliminated Miami from postseason contention. Ewers, a 7th-round pick by Miami earlier this year, will make his first career start on Sunday night against the Bengals, Coach Mike McDaniel said on Wednesday. From Eagan, Minnesota, the Vikings safety Josh Metellus was placed on injured reserve on Wednesday, ending his season early for shoulder surgery after playing with the injury for the past 3 months. 3 weeks, that is. Metellus, who signed a 3-year, $36 million contract extension before the season, had 86 tackles, a career-high 6 passes defensed, and 2 interceptions in 14 games for the Vikings. He's never before missed a game because of an injury over 6 seasons in the NFL, last sitting out a game in 2021 during the COVID-19. He joined edge rusher Jonathan Greenard on the injured reserve, leaving the Vikings without 2 starters on defense for his final 3 games. They were eliminated from contention in front of the playoffs last week. And that's the reading of the Arizona Daily Star for this Thursday. Mark DeGroft with you, wishing you a very good rest of your day, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds for more programming. Till next week, take care.